Well, hello everyone, and welcome again. I have James Sino on, and yet again, we are going to be talking about Chinese history, although we're taking, this is not a pun, a great leap forward from the Han, the establishment of the Han dynasty last time, to the establishment of the Ming dynasty, what, like 1,300 years later?
Yeah,
or is it 1,000 years later?
Late 1300s.
Okay.
After the fall of the, well, and this is what I'm going to talk about, the fall of the Mongol Yuan dynasty.
Okay, so we're going to get to all of that very soon. I have linked James's YouTube channel in the show notes. You can also find him on Twitter. I'll just remind people to pick up Foundations of Shakespeare in this beautiful edition, available on pre-order now. If you have the course, you can get it for 50% off if you send the receipt to the publisher. I'll give you a discount. Speaking of discounts, there is also a discount on my courses with promo code SHORJAN. I'll play the ad, and then we're going to talk about the Ming Dynasty and the Red Turban Rebellion, which sounds incredibly exciting.
Sure. Sure, 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 sure. And so, sure.
Sure, Jan.
Can you command a comma like Joseph Conrad?
Sure, sure, sure,
sure, sure, sure, and sure, Jan.
Are you magnificent in your mastery of marginalism like Murray Rothbard?
Sure,
sure, Jan.
Are you legendary in your logical leveling of lamentable loquacity?
Sure,
sure, Jan.
Come on down to the January sale at the Academic Agency. Promo code SHORJAN for 25% off. All this January, I got more courses than the Queen had horses.
SHORJAN.
I got better rates than Andrew Tate's had mates.
SHORJAN.
I got better deals than Lizzo's had meals.
Sure.
SHORJAN.
And so, sure, 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 and so, sure, sure, sure.
All right, so the establishment of the Ming Dynasty and the Red Turban Rebellion. Now, you have to bring us up to speed here. You don't have to give, like, 1,000 years of history right from the establishment of Han to now, but kind of just give us a little bit of the context of where we're coming in, okay?
All right. I suppose I'd have to start with the fall of the Sui dynasty and the establishment of the Mongol Yuan dynasty. And arguably, this is the first time in Chinese history that they fell to the horse peoples rather than an internal rebellion and were taken over from the top. This would later happen with the Manzhus, of course, with the Qing dynasty. So we're talking about the 1100s, the great barbarian horse people horde of the Mongols, which of course took over most of Central Asia and some of Western Europe, also had its effects on China, and they fell to the horse peoples, the Mongols. And this is important because what this meant was that most people who were Han under this period really suffered, and a lot of the Confucian literati were shut out from the dynasties, upper echelons. The Mongols placed their battalions in various cities throughout China, and their elites, but didn't have really much of a gateway in for the locals. So they were very much a top-down way of doing things. And this, of course, would be something that Zhu Yuanzhang would take advantage of.
And I hate to interrupt, but from my, again, limited dabbling understanding, I do have a book on the Mongols here as well, which I did look at with some interest. I don't know if I can find it at the moment. I read a bit about the Mongols. My understanding is that after Genghis Khan, after the initial kind of bursting out, okay, and after he dies, the Mongolian Empire, if you want, splits into what they call Khanates. Mm-hmm. Okay, I know Persia, or the area of Iran, became the Ilkhanate. and the area of China became its own khanate, right? And there were two other ones. Mm-hmm. And I think, what is it like? Was it Kublai Khan had four sons, and each one of them took a khanate? Was that right?
I think Genghis Khan was the one whose four sons had that. And then Kublai Khan was the one that got China.
Oh, right. Okay. So it was Genghis Khan's four sons. They each had a khanate, and Kublai Khan got China, which is, I guess, the jewel in the crown or something.
Yeah, it would have been to them. They'd been trying to get it for centuries. So, yeah. So in some ways, the Mongols did become Sinified. They didn't, for example, continue to pillage China, although they did it systematically. And of course, there were, I think it was around, off the top of my head, four or five Mongol emperors. So they lasted for around 100 years. But by the time of the late 1200s, a series of rebellions, and I should mention this, the north of China, the Yellow River Basin that we talked about a few videos ago, that was the core of Chinese civilization, emptied out during this period. People were moving south. The north saw a population collapse. Everyone was going south. The Han elite that had been shut out were moving south. Many peasants were moving south. The north emptied itself out. So this was a real period of turmoil for the Chinese people. And the resentment in the end boiled over into rebellions. The Great Jin Kingdom Rebellion of Guangzhou in 1337, the Sohonyu Rebellion 1348. These rebellions, with various reasons, snowballed one on top of the other. And their common goal was to remove the Yuan Mongols, because this was seen as an aberration on China. You know, we're the Chinese people. We're civilized. We don't want these barbarians to rule us. They resented it. And this boiled over in the end to the Red Turban Rebellion. That was a continuation and development of these movements.
Just before we get there, I remember reading about the history of Persia in this period, or history of Iran in this period. And what the Mongols did there is that they couldn't read or write. And obviously Persia had been a state for, you know, going back century, going all the way back to Cyrus. So they had an administrative capability. So the Mongols had to, like, they had no choice really, because they needed to collect taxes. And so the guys who ended up being the viziers and the administrators and so on were all Persian. Okay. Now, they treated them badly. There's stories of the Persian kind of advisor standing behind the Khan, and he kind of feeds him a scrap of meat and things like that, right? Which is obviously humiliating. But the point is that over time, obviously, this formed a bureaucracy, and the Mongols were basically schemed, foxed out of Persia. Because in the end, the Persians then, you know, end up reestablishing home rule. But they did it partly through fox tactics, as well as, I'm just wondering, did anything like that happen in the Chinese state? Because that had obviously been a bureaucracy for a long time as well. Did they employ any Chinese in administrative capacity?
Yeah, they did. But they certainly made sure that the upper echelons were gatekept. They had also laws, for example, against the population owning any swords, owning any horses, and if they did, they had to be registered. So I suppose these suppressive tactics might be familiar to some of us nowadays in our various contexts throughout the West. So there were some Han cooperation, but by and large people still saw this as an aberration, and Zhu Yuanzhang eventually would articulate that. The Red Turban Rebellion itself was in many ways familiar to some of us, a populist rebellion which drew in large numbers of people under various leaders. They had all different kinds of goals. Some of them were Maitreyist Buddhists, and they believed they were going to bring about a millenarian sort of belief that someone would come, someone would, a reincarnated Maitreya would arrive. And some of them saw that as a man known as Hanlinger, who led the Red Turban Rebellion for some time. And this was largely going on in the south, which was where Zhu Yuanzhang was. And Zhu Yuanzhang was the, I think, believe the fourth son of peasants, was destitute for this during this time. He, as the story goes, he actually joined a Buddhist monastery for some time and ran around with a begging bowl because he was an orphan. He'd lost his parents. But eventually he would join the Red Turban Rebellion, gain a name for himself as a warrior. Now, Zhu Yuanzhang is one of the very rare rulers in Chinese history who was a warrior. This is the exception to the rule. I might give the impression here in Chinese history that there were many warrior leaders, that they were very rare. Most leaders were perhaps writers. They may have been poets. But most of them, like I mentioned, Liu Bang, he was a delegator. Mm-hmm. But Zhu Yuanzhang was a warrior, and he led from the front with the Red Turban Rebellion.
And again, can you spell that for us?
Zhu Yuanzhang, Z-H-U-U-A-N-Z-H-A-N-G, Zhu Yuanzhang, or mm-hmm. Emperor Taizu, that's his other mm-hmm. name, Taizu. T-A-I-Z-U of the Ming, mm-hmm. the founder of the Ming dynasty. Yes, it can be very confusing, which is why in the Witten speech I did, I just focused on Xiang Yu and Liu Bang and just kept to those names. If you look on Wikipedia or whatever encyclopedia, these emperors have multiple names. They have a posthumous mm-hmm. name after they reign. They have a name they take on perhaps after they become a leader, like Liu Bang, who was actually born, I think, Liu Che, maybe, or mm-hmm. they have various names. So, Zhu Yuanzhang was the one I'm going to refer to him in this video.
Great. So, carry on. I just wanted to make sure people know exactly what person we're talking about.
Okay. So, as I mentioned before, the literati had been shut out mostly with the Yuan. So Zhu Yuanzhang begins to build around himself a counter-elite. People like Song Lian, people like Liu Ji were all Confucians. And as he begins to grow in power in the Red Turban Rebellion, he in fact marries the stepdaughter of the leader, Guo Zixing. He was the leader of the Red Turban Rebellion for a time. He marries his stepdaughter, one Lady Ma, I think was her eventual name. So he's rising up, he's being promoted as the stepson. He draws around him these marginalized elites, these Confucians, and some of them would eventually serve in the founding of the Ming dynasty as advisors or writers of proclamations. There's one in particular I need to mention later in 1368. So in this time, he begins to leave behind his Buddhist millenarian roots. He gives a nod to it, and he, for the time being, he bides his time. But events take place where he begins to really rise in power, and after the Battle of Lake Poliang against Chen Liang, another competing warlord. I should mention the Red Turban Rebellion wasn't the only one happening at this time. People had many reasons to join different rebellions, and they weren't the only one. But in the end, he turns his back on his roots, influenced by these Confucian elites that he draws around him, and becomes, in many ways, a archetypical Confucian ruler. And his goal after 1368, as he consolidated his power in the south, he could have just stayed there, but he wanted to remove the Mongols from the north. As he goes on to say in his proclamation in 1368, barbarians cannot sustain rule for 100 years. This was a man who saw this Mongol dynasty as a aberration, and many Chinese would have at this time. In fact, there is an irony. I've always thought that this was the first time Europeans came into contact directly with China, with, for example, Marco Polo visiting. So this has always coloured perhaps our perception of China, and later it would do with the Manzhous during the last imperial dynasty of China from the 1600s onwards. Our interactions with China has, on many occasions, been with a population, a native population, who were under the yoke of a barbarian dynasty. That was the Manzhous, that was the Yuan Mongols. So Marco Polo doesn't really see China, certainly as Zhu Yuanzhang saw that it should be, or that most Chinese saw that it should be. That's a fact that's always interested me. Anyway, I'm getting besides the point. My main thrust now is that he turns his back on this Red Turban rebellion movement, condemns these are his words, the strange cult-like secret societies that they grew out of with many different factions, and says, no, you know, we need to see Chinese rule restored in China, and gets to the core of what that means. Proper relations, we mentioned before, between brother and son, brother and younger brother, father and son. He condemns the Mongols for being against that. In the very proclamation that I mentioned in 1368, he condemns the Mongols for fighting each other over the crown, as the brothers would do. Now, not mm-hmm. that this didn't happen in Chinese history, but that at least it was frowned upon. It wasn't frowned upon in Mongol circles, as far as I can tell. So he condemns them for this, and really zooms in on the fact that, no, yes, they may have the levers of power. Yes, they may have in some ways become Sinified by cooperating with us and becoming a bureaucracy, but they're not Chinese. They're not Chinese, and they don't belong here. He really, really hammers this point home. Says, no, we need to see a restoration of Chinese rule in China. And he moves north after that proclamation, and the Mongols very rapidly disintegrate. And this is a real exception in the history of China, of the south taking the north. This very rarely happens. So he must have made a very persuasive case, because it worked.
Now, I've got two separate questions here. One, I just want to go back a little bit. Why were they called the Red Turban Rebellion? Did they just go around in red turbans? Because it strikes me that if you're leading a rebellion, it's pretty dangerous to wear a massive red turban, because it's like a target on your back.
I suppose so.
The authorities, so.
I think by that point, there were so many rebellions, as I mentioned before, that the Mongols were not deemed by anyone as legitimate by this point. They couldn't even keep their people safe. They couldn't even keep the south safe. Mm-hmm. By that point, there were even rebellions from 1296. And we're talking about here the 1360s, when the Red Turban Rebellion really gets going. As we've mentioned this in a previous video, the first rebellion gets crushed. And then by doing so clears a path for later rebellion. So I suppose by that point, they had confidence in announcing themselves as Red Turban Rebellion soldiers. And I suppose strength in numbers may have given them confidence to do that.
The original red cap wearers. It's kind of funny. Yeah. But the other question I had was, obviously, the Mongols were pretty fierce warriors. They took all this land. How comes they lost?
I suppose they'd lost that energy, hadn't they? They'd lost that energy, that will to rule anymore. They must have seen their other carnates falling. I think some of them had fallen by that point. And also, it's worth mentioning that in some ways, the horse people, I do frame it in this way sometimes, they had a parasitic relationship with the Han civilization, in that they needed to raid and get things, but they relied on the people to produce those things. And mm-hmm. and if they were ruling and shutting out locals from doing their thing as they would do if they weren't there, and siphoning off booty and loot, then, and as I've mentioned before, the North emptying itself out, this was a massive grain producing region, the Yellow River basin.
I mean, just from my understanding, had they been bugging the Chinese? Like, had they been raiding for the past
for centuries? We're talking about back to the Han Dynasty. Confucius was talking about hated Yi horse peoples, who he saw them as different from themselves. They'd been building walls since that time. A fact I should mention is that the Great War, as we know it, didn't come into being off of a single dynasty and one ruler. Qin Shi Huang may have combined them into and brought them forward into the future with a vision of, oh, we're going to link these up. We're going to link these existing walls up. We're going to use them to keep out the horse peoples. But they had been built from the Warring States period. The separate mm-hmm. states all built their own walls, sometimes to defend from each other, but mostly to defend from the horse peoples north of the Yellow River. Mm. So it was only the fact that Qin Shi Huang, the unifier in 221 BC, decided, oh, we've got these walls, let's bring them with us into the future. So yeah, those horse peoples have been raiding China for centuries. And as I mentioned, one might say it was parasitic. So I suppose when they take away their very mode of getting loot from themselves, then their very existence ceases to be self-justifying.
Hmm. Very, very interesting. I know in the case of, they tell the story in the case of when they took Persia, because that's the period, that's the bit of it that I know best. But when the Mongols actually got there, initially they didn't want to live in the cities. They were just living in tents outside, and they were trying to rule from the tent. And that, where it kind of started to fall apart from them is when they actually moved from the tent actually into the palace, and they kind of became decadent, basically.
Yeah.
And like, oh right, we're living, it's like, oh, we're living in modernity now, we're not living in a tent outside, I'm now the king type thing. And it's just like, well, they became like softer and weaker as a result. Yeah.
That's something they were aware of and saw themselves falling to. And it's something also that the later Manzus didn't want to do. But of course, the later rulers were cut off from reality in the palace just as much, perhaps, as these Yuan rulers were. I mean, there's the poets, isn't there? The tale of Kublai Khan, I think it was,
mm-hmm.
was it by a Victorian poet? Right, yeah, there's some truth to that. Coleridge, yeah. There's some truth to that. They did become decadent, and they didn't have, I suppose, one might say, the internal characteristics to bringing about stability and sort of consolidating a long-lived dynasty. As Zhu Yuanzhang said, barbarians cannot sustain rule for 100 years, and they didn't. He was right.
Very interesting indeed. So anyway, carry on. I cut you off.
All right.
I didn't remember where you were. Right. Yeah.
So I was just getting to 1368 and Zhu Yuanzhang sort of betraying, in a way, his Buddhist red turban roots. So he marches north, and with this elite, mostly Confucian elite, and he establishes Chinese rule in China once more. And those elites that he'd brought with him, mostly Confucian, helped him do that. We're only talking about 100 years after the Sui dynasty. So within a couple of generations, the people did remember, they recollected a time when they weren't under the Mongol yoke. So in some ways, it's a lot easier for them to put it all back together and rule from, as he, at the start, he ruled from Nanjing, but his in the south, but his grandson, Zhu Di, would move the capital to Beijing, as we know it now, and build the Forbidden City. That was under the Ming Dynasty, under the founder's grandson. So we see there is this energy to the Ming Dynasty that was martial at the start, mm-hmm. with Zhu Yuanzhang being a warrior, very much a lion figure, and a rare exception in Chinese history, a man who founds, not only removes a hated foreign entity, but also establishes a long-lived dynasty. Very, very rare. He's an exceptional figure, if I may say so.
And just for my understanding, this is different, the Forbidden City in Beijing, and this is a separate capital from the one that the Han established all that time, that palace that you mentioned last time. How comes it moved? Do you know?
Well, there are various theories. For some reason, I'm not quite sure why the UN decided to put their capital there. Perhaps it was near their base in Mongolia. Shenyang in the west, modern day Xi'an, had fallen into disrepair by that time. I mentioned the Weiyang Palace, which was built in Liu Beng's time in 200 BC. By the Sui Dynasty, we're talking about 800 years. And then also there's the fact that the Grand Canal had been built by that point that connected the Yangtze to the Yellow River. So the Yellow River is quite near modern day Beijing. When a river meets the sea, the words escape me now. Delta, right. It's not far from there. So by now you have the ability to bring up things from the south a lot faster. So I suppose Zhu Yuanzhang and the Ming Dynasty piggybacks off that fact. The UN did not build the Forbidden City. No, they didn't build it, but they certainly established their capital there. I suppose with hindsight, it was a mistake. It was a mistake because eventually the Ming would collapse to the horse peoples, because they're so close to the walls there in the northeast. Beijing is very exposed. It's a very exposed capital, unlike Shenyang in the west, modern-day Xi'an. That's very much more internal to that core of China that we've spoken about before, that geographic region. It's the very reason why the Manzhous could take over so easily. They were very in the northeast, in Manchuria. They're very close to the capital and could take it very easily. Perhaps the Ming should have kept the capital in the south, in Nanjing, for tactical reasons. But I suppose, why did they establish it there? Well, the UN had already done it, so they just piggybacked off it.
Interesting. So they were established by overthrowing the horse people, but then they fell to the horse people again. How long did it last, the Ming Dynasty?
Oh, crikey, 300 years. A pretty good click. For much of the time, they emphasized the laws and the... In fact, in many ways, Zhu Yuanzhang revived the legalist tradition. He was all for harsh punishments as well. He looked back on the figures of old and saw himself in their light. He tried to copy Liu Beng, who I mentioned before, who was a peasant himself. They very much identified Zhu Yuanzhang as a Liu Beng-like figure, a man who would bring about a lasting peace. And this was something his proclamation writers would emphasize. You know, he wrote, "And though I'm not a man of noble blood, I'm a peasant from the south." Yeah, but all the literati worth their salt remembered Liu Beng was also a peasant from the south. Liu Beng was also a man who brought in Confucian traditions, Confucian virtue, at least in its ideal, eventually. So he very much appealed to that tradition.
Yeah, and it's just a fascinating example of how, when you're dealing with a civilization, a proper civilization like the Chinese, they can draw on this history. They can look back, they can see, they can pinpoint, they can see how it rhymes. They're aware of themselves. And this is kind of what the nature of a civilization is. This is something that I think is important. So it's something I've tried to emphasize myself to think civilizationally. Our leaders at the moment love to establish territories that don't have this, like fake countries, right? I'm not going to mention anyone in particular, but it's like, it really matters that the Chinese are able to do this. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Obviously, Europeans can do this too, but certain other countries and nations are often the ones that they like to embroil in conflict, aren't civilizations in that way, or they become like conflict zones. You know, I mean, what's the maximally inoffensive one I could pick? Belgium, maybe? I don't know. But like, I'm just trying to not get too bogged down in current politics. But it is like, I think it makes a huge difference if a people is able to draw on hundreds of years of history. In a way, you can see how these figures draw strength from then looking at the past. They can draw strength in the future by looking at the past. But obviously that cannot express itself if you're always running your own past down, or if you're running your own culture down, or your own history down. So, you know, yeah.
Absolutely. And I should also note that, of course, this goes without saying, study your own history. I suppose I'm bringing a different angle to this, and in a way it's implicit. By studying Chinese history, I'm acknowledging the greatness in that. But there's no harm, as I've mentioned before, in acknowledging greatness in someone else when one sees it, because we identify that greatness within ourselves as well. It takes confidence to go, no, we can pinpoint what's great about this, not because we're resentful, not because we envy it, but because we see that in ourselves as well. We see that in our own history. So this goes without saying, one should study one's own history as well as looking at examples in others as for how to do this. And one of the main things I drew out from the Red Turban Rebellion is that these populist revolts and rebellions don't tend to establish order. They never do. There was a Yellow Turban Rebellion at the end of the Han Dynasty as well that was also populist in nature and broad-tented and perhaps peasant-led. But people miss the wood for the trees sometimes. I've had comments of people on Twitter saying, well, Liu Bang was a peasant. Yes, but he was surrounded by an elite. They missed the wood for the trees. There was Zhu Yuanzhang was a peasant. Yes, he was. But he was also surrounded by an elite who were marginalized. And I think people should be able to dot the I's and cross the T's and see the similarities of our own time. It should be obvious.
But also, I mean, one of the things I've noticed about some of these great men in history, you know, we mentioned Genghis Khan earlier. He was another one. They often have really rough upbringings, you know, periods of suffering, because there's stuff that you could learn in that hardship that you might not learn in the luxury of the court.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, even today, even the present day Chinese leader, Xi, and Deng, if you read about his history, they had rough periods in their lives. This is. I mean, even in the current conflict, the current, you know, he's 85 now, but the current ruler of Iran had periods of roughness in his life. And it's like that creates a different sort of character, And this is sometimes why I wonder if, you know, likes of Keir Starmer and friends know what they're up against, you know, when they're up against some of these sorts of characters. Different, just cut from a different cloth.
I think they have no idea. I don't think they barely met people like that, frankly. Frankly, the closeted and sort of cut off from reality leaders who oversaw the fall of the Qin dynasty that I mentioned in the first video, back in 221 BC, Qin Ershi was forced to call a deer a horse in court. You know, this is a Zhulu Wei Ma in Chinese. The eunuch who put him into power brought in a a stag to court and as a loyalty test said, look, this is what you see here. It's actually a horse. Now, anyone who disagrees with me, stand on this side. Anyone who agrees with me, stand on this side. And of course, all the court realizes he's in power and they all go along with him and call it a horse. I mean, it goes without saying, we're now being asked to call a stag a horse in our own time, in many different ways.
Sounds so familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah. And those leaders were so cut off, like you mentioned, people who may lead us now, I think they're completely detached. And it's repeating itself, unfortunately.
Yeah.
It's part of the nature.
It's also worth mentioning, though, because I've been very critical of the right wing in recent weeks. So many of them venerate the aesthetics and the trappings of, let's say, the aristocracy or this nobility or this king or that king, forgetting the fact that so many dynasties, so many monarchies, the first king usually comes from often comes from one of these kind of backgrounds where they had it hard in their early life. Mm. Pretty much all the great men I can think of, you know, have something like this. I mean, going to European history, they said Charlemagne couldn't read or write.
Alfred.
Rough manners, you know, this is something that just repeats over and over. And it's possible in our current context that, you know, the people who will be able to do it may come from the working class, or they may not come from, you know, people who are cloistered. They may come from people who, you know, who've known real life.
Absolutely. By definition, it cannot come from people like that. They can't even call a horse a horse now, right? So they're so deluded. It beggars belief sometimes. I suppose that in the times of Xiang Yu, people would have felt the same. Remember that the Qin dynasty would have seemed invincible. They would have seemed invincible. They just built the terracotta warriors using hundreds of thousands of forced labor conscripts. Within 20 years, they fall.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been absolutely fascinating, James. People can find you on Twitter. I've put your YouTube in the show notes. I'll just remind people, pick up a course at the Academic Agency, promo code SHORJAN. Hopefully, people found this interesting and, in some respects, inspiring as well. You talk about this all the time on your channel, right? So if you're interested in this, you can go and watch more detail. But this was a kind of a nice taster. Thanks a lot, James.
Thanks for having me.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just 3 of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.